So this morning we started out with first level modeling topics. I just wanted to set up for the afternoon. The afternoon of a Bayesian methods, two talks related to Bayesian methods for second level or group modeling of fMRI. And when we're setting this schedule up, we were kind of thinking, what's going on in group fMRI? Isn't that kind of sorted out? And we weren't quite sure. I mean, there's been a lot of work done in that area. So we closed today with a panel session with a bunch of esteemed experts. And we'll basically kind of go through and see what is left. Is group fMRI a dead area? And I think, well, at least the two talks that you'll see in the afternoon answer that question. No, it isn't. But what are the kind of remaining opportunities? So let's start off on time even with Martin Lindquist coming from Columbia University, and we'll be talking about HRF modeling.
Can you hear me? Hi, I'm Martin Lindquist from the Department of Statistics at Columbia University, and the title of my talk is Modeling fMRI Data with Uncertain Hemodynamic Response or Stimulus Functions. And I have to admit that even though the title of this session is first level modeling, there's going to be plenty of second level modeling as well, so, you know, caveat there. So kind of an introduction here is you know, functional MRI. I guess last week you talked about other things, and so this is, you know, the beginning of your functional MRI part of the course. Functional MRI performed using blood oxygenation level dependent contrast, or BOLD contrast, can be used to detect changes in blood oxygenation and blood flow that occur in response to some neural activity. And so a primary goal of fMRI research is to use this information provided by the BOLD signal to make conclusions about, you know, this underlying neuronal activity. And so here's a little cartoon here, setting up my talk here and the different topics I hope to talk about today. You know, first we have we have the stimulus here, and you know, so we apply some stimulus to the subject while they're in the scanner. And let's say, you know, for sake of argument, that there's some flashing light that appears, you know, in random intervals here. So these are little flashing lights that appear at those spikes. And, you know, this stimulus gives rise to some neuronal activity in the brain. So there's certain regions that are active, you know, in this case maybe the visual cortex. And that leads to changes in hemodynamics. And so in the blood flow and blood oxygenation in the brain. And that is what we're kind of privy to in the MRI scanner. So what we have is we have this kind of indirect measure of what's going on in the brain. So it's kind of this hemodynamic response to stimulus and neuronal activity. Now, indeed, you know, the signal that we get in fMRI doesn't look so nice. It's noisy as well. So this is kind of an idealized picture of what it looked like. Then you can think of it as being a noisy image like that. So the topic of this particular talk is twofold. So when I was asked to give this talk, they asked me to talk a little about HRF modeling. But then when I was thinking about it, I had another project that I also thought fit in very well here. So I decided to make this into a kind of a two-part talk. So the first part here is given this data, so given this noisy hemodynamics and the stimulus function over here, we want to estimate what's called the hemodynamic response function. So we want to, you know, estimate what is the brain's kind of the blood hemodynamic instantaneous response to some neuronal activity. So if I have a spike here, how does the brain hemodynamics work? And so it might look something like this. The second part of it, and we also want to talk a little bit about how can we interpret this hemodynamic response function once we estimate it? You know, what can we say about the shape of the HRF and whatnot? The second part of the talk, which I kind of added, you know, in the planning stages here, is, well, what if we're only given these hemodynamics? We don't actually know what the stimulus is. So instead of having a flashing checkerboard appear at random time intervals, what if it's a kind of a cognitive task where you don't really know what's going on? It could be like a stress task or some emotion task and things like that. Well, you don't really know when brain regions are turning on and off in the same way as you know when you flash a checkerboard in someone's face. So that's the second part of the talk here. So I think that these two guys kind of fit together here, and so I want to give a little bit of detail on both these topics. So the first thing I want to talk about is modeling the hemodynamic response. So a number of methods exist for modeling this relationship between stimulus and BOLD function. And so usually you know, one can separate them in kind of a linear model, so that you have linear time invariant system. And in this case, you know, the relationship between the stimulus and the brain hemodynamics is modeled using kind of a convolution model. So you have this HRF, let's assume that we know this, and if we convolve the stimulus with this HRF, we would get our predicted Bold signal. So that's kind of the idea behind this linear time invariant system. So the Bold responses add linearly, and this the appealing thing about this linear time invariant system is it's extremely easy to use, and this is kind of the dominant thing that people do when they use this so-called GLM analysis in functional MRI. And I'll give a couple of background slides on the GLM in a second. So this is kind of a very, you know, common approach to modeling this relationship. However, there do exist other types of model. There are nonlinear models, and one of the more famous is called the balloon model, which kind of tries to attempt to model, you know, what's going on in the brain, how blood flow is changing, how the oxygenation level is changing, you know, as a function of all these different parameters. And so basically these nonlinear models consist of a set of ordinary differential equations, which you can solve, and somehow, you know, from the input, you can solve these equations, and you can get some type of, estimate the parameters of this hemodynamic response. So this is you know, significantly more advanced than just using the linear time invariant system, and it's significantly more time consuming. And so time is really of essence in fMRI analysis, because if you're thinking about this, is, you know, you might have, you know, 100,000, 200,000 voxels for a single subject, and you might have 20, 30 subjects, and so you really want to make shortcuts at the right time, and if you have something that's a little simpler that, you know, speeds it up, and you don't lose much by doing that, it's usually quite beneficial to do that. And so most people use this linear time invariant system, even though this is kind of often sold as being more biophysically plausible or whatever. But both types provide a means for estimating the HRF. So in this talk, I'm really going to concentrate on this linear time invariant system throughout, but I just wanted to, you know, kind of make it clear to you guys that there exist alternatives, but it's very hard to do it in these kind of whole brain analysis that at least, you know, with my colleagues and I were interested in. All right, so the ability to accurately model the evoked hemodynamic response to a neuronal event plays a really important role. And we'll see it later on when we start talking about this general linear model and whatnot, is that if you don't have a good estimate of the hemodynamic response, you can have problems with, you know, false positives and false negatives and all types of things, and your statistics can be invalid and even worse. So it's very important to be able to do that. And so me and my colleagues, when we analyze the shape of the estimated HRF, we're often interested in certain summary measures, such as the amplitude of the HRF, the delay, how long it takes for it to start moving, and how wide the HRF is. So once you have an estimate of the HRF, you can extract this information. And at the end of the day, you're not interested in the HRF per se, perhaps, but you want to be able to infer information regarding, you know, intensity, onset, latency, and duration of this underlying neuronal activity. Because at the end of the day, that's what you really want to know. So here's kind of another little image here showing we get some estimate of the HRF. So this is the kind of the brain's reaction to a stimulus. So I flash a checkerboard here. So what happens is that it sends out signals, in my layman term, and a lot of heavily oxygenated blood comes to the brain, you know, 5 or 6 seconds later, and then it kind of stabilizes after, you know, 20 to 25 seconds. So this is the type of signal that you'd expect in a region of the brain that has been active. And so in particular, what we've been interested in is estimating the amplitude, so the height of this HRF, the time to peak, which is the time to the top point there, which is capital T, as well as the full width at half max. So this is this at 50% amplitude, the width of the HRF. So that, you know, there are other types of measures you could do to do time. You could do onset as the onset of HRF or whatnot. But this is what we decided to do. Typically, most inference in the statistical analysis of fMRI data is primarily focused on this amplitude. So you use this amplitude in your inference. But we're interested in using these other measures as well and seeing what type of information they provide us with. So ideally, these parameters, you know, this HT and W, which I call here, they should be directly interpretable in terms of changes in neuronal activity, and they should be estimated so statistical power is maximized. So here's kind of a little slide that was made by my colleague Tor Wager. This is joint work with him, showing kind of an image of the relationship between these different things. So we have neuronal activity, and so neuronal activity leads to changes in the true bold response. And it's the true bold response that we have a noisy measure of this true bold response, and so we estimate, you know, the parameters of this. We have some model to estimate parameters associated with this true bold response, and these are the estimated parameters. So each of these things have a couple of things associated, parameters associated. So the neuroactivity has, you know, there's increases in firing rate, increases in onset latency and duration of activity. And that somehow, changes in these guys somehow lead to changes in magnitude, time to peak, and response duration, and the true bold response, and finally an estimation of those parameters. So the questions that we want to ask in interpreting, you know, these measures of height, you know, time to peak and width are, do changes in parameters related to neural activity directly translate into changes in corresponding parameters in the HRF? So in this case, you know, firing rate might be considered to be corresponding to magnitude, onset latency to time to peak, etc. So ideally, in an interpretation, you'd want there to be kind of a one-to-one relationship between them. But it turns out that, you know, if you have an increased duration of activity, that might not only impact the response duration, but it also could impact the magnitude of the response and whatnot. So that complicates interpretation. So usually this is something that, you need to model, or you need to make some sort of assumptions about this, because both of these things we're not really privy to this information. So these are links that on two things that we can't really see. So it's very complicated unless we model that. However, this is something that we can very much understand. If the true magnitude of the bold response increases, only the true magnitude increases, well, then we would expect any statistical model that estimates that magnitude to only impact the height. Ideally, also, if the time to peak increases, well, that should only change the time to peak of the estimated parameter, and the same for response duration. So in this case, if the magnitude increases, we don't want the time to peak or the width to change, right? Because this is an estimate of that. So, and this is something that we can actually quantify using simulations to determine whether a series of different models, which of them are best at kind of keeping this one-to-one correspondence between these two parameters, and which are quite poor at that. And it turns out that not all models are created equal. So there's a lot of kind of confusability between these parameters. So that's the second part. So basically, you know, the bold physiology limits the interpretability of parameters in terms of neuronal and metabolic function. And so this is kind of a repeat of what I said. So in this work, we're treating the evoked bold response as the signal of interest.
Pointer for you.
Oh, okay. As a signal of interest without making any direct links to the neuronal activity. So here we're going to primarily focus on the ability of different models to recover differences in height, time to peak, and width of the bold response. And then, so basically what we want to determine is which model is most efficient while giving rise to the least amount of bias and model misspecification. Yes?
The parameters homogeneous for all the brain, or we should...
They should be different across the brain. So we'll kind of, that's a very good question. So that's a very important thing. But I'll get to that. I think I'll answer that question. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to concentrate on this LTI system, so this linear time invariant system. And so this is by far the most dominant analysis strategy. And so one assumes that the bold response to events add linearly and use a set of smooth functions to model the underlying hemodynamic response function. And indeed, there's been a lot of research on this. Is it linear? Is it not linear? And it turns out that, you know, usually if the spacing of the trials are significantly far apart, it's usually pretty accurate to assume this linear time invariant system. If they're too close together, there might be some nonlinearity involved. So this is an area of a lot of research. But you know, the most dominant analysis strategy is to use this linear time invariant S system. And so in this linear time invariant system, the stimulus is acting as the input, and the HRF is acting as their impulse response function. So basically, this is just a convolution model where you take the stimulus, and let's say that you know the HRF for the time being, well, then the bold response should just be the convolution of the two. So here's kind of an image of this. These are two different types of experimental designs, and I think the third talk is dealing with experimental design, so you'll talk about block design and event related, but this is the block design where you do a task for like 20 seconds of finger tapping, 20 seconds of rest, 20 seconds of finger tapping, 20 seconds of rest, or something like that. In this case, you have this block design, you have the human dynamic response function, and then you take the convolution of that and you get this green, that's your estimated bold response. Similarly, for the event-related, here there's little spikes, maybe it's flashing checkerboards or something like that are appearing at kind of random time intervals. You convolve that with this, then you get your expected bold response. She looks something like this green guy. So they look quite different depending on what kind of stimulus you have. So this is all good and well, but you know, right now what we have is we're privy to a kind of a noisy version of this. I don't think that's working so well, so I'm going to switch. A noisy version of this, and we know this, so we want to estimate that. So again, that's kind of the problem that we're interested in. And so we can do this in this, you know, so-called GLM framework. And so for those of you who are kind of unfamiliar with fMRI data analysis, you know, the first thing that you need to familiarize yourself with is the GLM approach. And so this is by far the most dominant way of statistically analyzing fMRI data. So basically what it does is you just construct an enormous multiple regression model and fit it to different boxes of the brain. And so the general linear model approach treats the data as a linear combination of predictors plus some noise. And so here the predictors of the model functions, they're assumed to have a known shape. So you as the analyst, you know, you specify the known shape of these predictors, but their amplitudes are unknown and need to be estimated. So that's kind of the goal. It's a kind of a rigid model approach. You're saying, well, I expect the bold signal to look kind of like this, and then I just want to estimate the amplitude. If the amplitude is not significantly different from zero, well, then that bold component is not in that particular voxel. If it is significant, well, then it appears that it is in that voxel. And so this GLM framework is very popular because it encompasses many of the commonly used techniques in fMRI data analysis, ANOVA, t-tests, and whatnot. So here's the standard GLM model. I kind of put this in early this morning because I realized that I was the first lecture, and everyone's going to talk about GLM. So I just wanted to make sure everyone's on the same page. So this is kind of the GLM model. Here it's written out in matrix notation. So basically what we have here is we have the fMRI data, which is here, you know, temporally strung out. This is from a single voxel of the brain. So this is kind of the massive univariate approach. You take one voxel of the brain, you kind of string out the time course associated with it. So there's little n time points here. Then you have this design matrix, and that's where all your knowledge about the experiment comes into play. So you have a baseline signal here. You might put in your bold response. You might put in any like drift or whatnot, whatever type of components you want to be able to model. And so these are the fixed, you know, predictors that we need to include. And that is an analysis. We need to put that in ourselves. All right. So and then we estimate these unknown model parameters, and then we have noise. Okay, so this design matrix, this is also something you often see in these fMRI talks. Sometimes they're written with these like heat maps so that you can get a better feel for what's going on. So when in Rome, so I did that as well. So this is kind of an on-off type of regressor for the first. And here's just a series of ones. And then this is a discrete cosine basis, which is used to model drift. So you'll often see in fMRI papers and whatnot these type of things. So basically what that is just a heat map of this matrix where our model knowledge is coming into play. All right, so we assume this model, and you know, I think maybe Steve might talk about this, but fMRI data is temporally autocorrelated. You know, usually it's modeled using, you know, an AR process or an ARMA 1-1 process, AR1 plus white noise type process, but usually there's an autocorrelation present. And so the optimal solution for this unknown data, given that you know this autocorrelation function is given by this. So what do I mean by optimal solution? Well, I mean optimal in the sense that it's what's called the blue. It's the best linear unbiased estimate. So basically, what this says, out of the class of all possible estimates, so there's more than one estimate here, beta hat of beta, the expected value of beta hat here is equal to beta, so on average it's giving us the correct result. But out of the class of all possible estimates that give us the correct result, this is the one that has the smallest variability, so this is the best linear unbiased estimate. And then once we have that in the GLM framework, you know, we can use linear combinations of these beta hats to perform inference. So I might have two different conditions where I have, you know, a painful stimulus and I have a low pain and high pain. So I have a beta corresponding to each of them, and I might want to look at a contrast between the two to see whether there's a significant difference in different brain voxels. And I can do this within this framework, okay, because I know that these are normally distributed, and so I can do a t-test. Okay. So, all right, so this is all well and... So how does this fit together with the HRF estimation? Well, it turns out that you can do HRF estimation within this GLM framework. So instead of including just one single predictor corresponding to the HRF, you can have many different predictors corresponding to different components of the HRF, and you can combine them using what's called basis functions. So a linear combination of several basis functions can be used to account for possible delays and dispersions in the HRF. And so this comes in, because now if you fit it to different brain voxels, you might get different combinations. So this is allowing you to have different HRFs across the brain. So it is possible to model that. And so, and you should do it. And the stimulus function is now convolved with each of these basis functions to get a set of regressors. So you got one for each of these basis components. And then the parameter estimates give the coefficients that determine which combination of basis function is good for that particular voxel or trial type. So what are common basis functions? Well, you know, here are some, probably the most common is you know, I guess this SBM has this canonical HRF, which is, you know, the linear combination of two gamma functions. And so sometimes they use this canonical HRF plus two derivatives. That's very common. And that looks like this. So this is the canonical HRF. This is the first derivative of the canonical HRF, and this is the second derivative. And including these two things kind of allow you to shift the onset of the HRF and also widen the width of the HRF for different voxels. Okay, so basically, now the HRF estimate is going to be a linear combination of these three guys, which gives you a little bit more flexibility. If you're only using the canonical HRF, well, you're always going to get the same estimate. And that's the most flexible model. We use this a lot is a finite impulse response function. So basically, here you have a variable for each time point following, you know, stimulus. So you have a beta 1 corresponding to the first, beta 2, et cetera, all the way down to, say, beta 30 or whatever it is you have. And so this allows you to model pretty much any shape that you want. However, it also allows you to model a lot of noise, so there's issues involved with that. But there's a lot of different basis sets, but the general flavor of them is just to provide flexibility of modeling differences in onset and width across different boxes. So here's some cartoons here. Here's if you only do a single HRF. Here's a little heat map for that. And so here the actual data is this spiky guy here, and the canonical HRF of course has no flexibility whatsoever. It always has the same shape, so its estimate is going to be whatever you tell it, and so that doesn't fit this very well. Here, if you include the two derivative terms, you know, the price you pay is now you have three model parameters instead of one. So, here you're able to more accurately kind of fit the general shape here. It doesn't fit this here, but it kind of fits the time to peak and the amplitude. And here is the finite impulse response function. And so here you have a parameter for each time point following activation. And here, you know, you have like too good of a fit. So you're really overfitting it. You're probably fitting the noise quite a bit there. So, you know, there's kind of a trade-off between these things. It's fitting this very well, but it's not going to fit the next data set because it's going to have a different noise. So this FIR solution tends to be quite noisy, as we see here. So you're overfitting and you're fitting the noise. And so often to constrain the fit to be smoother but otherwise of arbitrary shape, you can put a Gaussian prior on the filter parameter. So you can constrain that that the betas correspond to this time point and the beta correspond to the next adjacent time point, they have to be close to each other. So there's a penalty that tells them that they can't be far away from each other. And this makes it a smoother fit. And so if you give the parameters of this Gaussian prior, basically what this becomes is a ridge regression. So it's basically just kind of a penalized least square fit here. So, and then you use the maximum a posteriori, and you're going to hear that a lot this afternoon, I think, estimate of beta, because this is in a Bayesian framework, and this gives a smooth version of the filter. So here's kind of the flavor of it. So this is kind of a noisy FIR solution, so it's kind of overfitting and fitting the noise. If we put a smoothness constraint on it, you get this smooth FIR, which looks like this. Now there's a bit of shrinkage around the amplitude because you're putting this penalty on it. But this is, we've had a lot of success using this smooth FIR in Tor in my work. All right, so as an alternative, you know, one can also use nonlinear models. You're still in this linear time invariant system, so I don't mean nonlinear in the sense of the balloon model. I mean nonlinear in the sense of modeling the HRF. So in this case, you can use nonlinear models with free parameters for magnitude and onset and peak delay. And so common criticisms of these types of approaches are they're very computationally expensive. Remember, we had, you know, hundreds of thousands of voxels for each subject. We had 20, 30 subjects and whatnot. And so, and also, there's these potential convergence problems. However, you know, we found that, you know, every year our computers are getting much better, so this has become less of a problem in recent years. And so what we suggest is the following model, which is the superposition of three different inverse logit or sigmoid functions. So basically you have one sigmoid function, and this is the equation there, modeling the rise. You have one modeling the decay, and then one modeling this undershoot. And so if you take the linear combination of the three, you get kind of a nice shape of the HRF. And so each of these functions has three variable parameters, because we write it in this term where L is this function here. So we have one parameter which is shifting the middle point here back and forth. So that's T1, T2, and T3, respectively. And then we have also one parameter that's telling you how quick you rise up between 0 and 1. That's this D parameter, and then you have an amplitude as well. I always think of this model as kind of an accordion, so you have this kind of thing that you can press it back and forth until you fit the HRF. And so that was kind of the reason for using this particular thing. And I mean, there's nothing holy about the inverse logit of the sigmoid function. I think any kind of like CDF type thing could work, but I think that just that general philosophy of kind of playing the accordion with your HRF, it's been very, very, very successful for us. And so basically, you know, this provides a lot of flexibility. So shifting the position of the second function, so by only shifting the, you know, the T2 term, you know, you can model differences in durations here. So you get a pretty flexible difference in duration. And then by modeling all three IO functions, just the T term, you can model differences in onset and things. So we've had good luck with this guy. And we usually do model fitting, you know, using simulated annealing or gradient descent, and we constrain the solution so that the response begins and ends at zero. It leads to a model with seven parameters. And we have an alternative where we just model kind of the time points and the sums. We constrain, you know, how fast it goes between zero and one, and that's only four parameters, and that's lightning quick, so that's really nice. So now I'm going to compare these different models in a simulation. I should probably hurry up a little bit because I have a second part. And the models we studied were this canonical HRF, the canonical HRF plus first and second, these FIR models, the inverse logit model, and also a nonlinear gamma. So basically we just took the canonical HRF and let all the parameters of that vary, and we fit it using kind of nonlinear methods. And these are all GLM-based, and these are all nonlinear, so they're more time-consuming. After fitting each model, we estimated these parameters that we were interested in using closed-form solutions when available. And otherwise, we read them off in the fitted HRF. One of the kind of a pet peeve I've always had is that usually when people use these HRFs with temporal derivatives and they do second level modeling and things like that, they usually only use the dominant, you know, the canonical term in the second level and kind of throw out the information about the first and second derivative term. And that's always struck me as kind of irrational. So we use kind of something called derivative boost, which takes this into consideration of Devinsky Calhoun, who will be speaking here later this week. We did the following simulation, where basically what we have here, so here's the short story, is we had five different HRF shapes with different width and different time to peak. And for each of these guys, each row had one of these HRFs. And then we also, as a second parameter, we shifted them in time, the onset of them. So we had five different HRFs with five different onset times for a total of 25 different HRFs. We then repeated this 10 times, and then we fit it using each of these models, put noise on it and whatnot. So we generated 15 subjects, which consisted of the true bold time series plus white noise, and we put in plausible effect size and whatnot. And then we estimated the amplitude, time to peak, and width for each model. And then we took the average value and compared it with true values to assess model-dependent bias in the estimates. So, you know, ideally there shouldn't be any bias, because all we did was change the if we're just changing the magnitude of the height, that shouldn't impact the width or the time to peak, right? So if it does, we're going to get bias in those estimates, and that's going to show whether there's confusability between these things. And also we did some model misspecification. And so this is the way we did model misspecification, is we just took the residuals and we convolved it with the Gaussian kernel. And because if the model is good, there should be no signal left in the residuals. So this is a way of looking for signal that remains. So under the null hypothesis, this should all be normal zero, normal would mean zero, but we can use random field theory to calculate p-values to see whether that's true or not. Here are the results here, and here we see that actually the true HRF corresponded to gamma. So in the upper right-hand corner, that's the correct model. So that does very well in those situations, but it quickly decays as the shape becomes more and more complex, because this is a very rigid model that doesn't allow for any flexibility. It's just this canonical gamma function. The temporal derivative helps a little bit with that, as does the second derivative, but minimally. But they're going to have a lot of problem here when you have big shifts in onset and duration. You're going to get a lot of mismodeling there. The FIR and the smooth FIR kind of take care of a lot of those things, as does the nonlinear and the IL model. The nonlinear is very biased for some reason for the width, and it has a lot of mismodeling. We'll come back to that in a second. So as a second step, we perform population inference using the estimated amplitude for each subject and one of the following three methods. We use the summary statistics approach, which is the common way of doing it. You just take all the heights and you calculate a t-test, basically. But that assumes normality. And we had two non-parametric tests which did not assume normality. And basically we looked for the ability to pick up activations and false positives. And here we see that, you know, these gamma models are very good when there's minimal craziness in the HRF, but when it becomes too different, it kind of falls apart here, all these guys. The FIR and the smooth FIR are pretty good. The smooth FIR is actually a little better, and the IL, of course, does very well. But this nonlinear guy, it picks up all the activations, but it also picks up a lot of false positives, an awful lot of false positives. And the reason for that is that its whole null hypothesis distribution is shifted, is biased positively, so it's going to be not such a hot model. All right, so the conclusions here, so I want to move to the second half here, is that these canonical HRF-based models are highly susceptible to model misspecification. So they're awesome if they're true, but if they're not, that they're not so great. These FIR models and the IL models, they provide the most flexible means of handling differences in onset and duration. And, you know, the IL model performs quite well, but I have to be honest, the caveat is it is much more computationally demanding than the FIR models. So you know, if time is of essence, these FIR models do perform quite well. All right, so that was the first part of the talk. So given data and the stimulus function, we want to estimate the hemodynamic response function. Now, as a second part of this talk, which is another research project that we're working on, is given the data only, can we estimate activity? Okay, so now what we have is we have a noisy measurement of this, and we want to find out, well, what the heck is going on in the brain? So what can we say about what's going on in the brain? So this is kind of, it fits in the same general overview, but it's now slightly different. We don't have the stimulus to help us out, and we want to make as good conclusions as possible what's going on in the brain at the moment. So most statistical analysis will always assume that the timing and duration of the processes that you're studying are known. You know, if you're assuming this linear time invariant system, you have to know what the stimulus function is, and that's what you usually do in the GLM. However, in many studies, specifically studies that we've been interested in, it's very hard to specify this information a priori, and these could be studies of, say, threat or emotional experience, and also in drug uptake. So there's some drug companies that you know, they want to see when the drug is being up to, you know, being used in the brain, but they don't have any, they don't know exactly when that's taking place, so they don't have this kind of stimulus function. So in these situations, using standard GLM-based analysis isn't appropriate, and alternatives need to be explored, and that's what we did here. So what we did is we used methods from change point analysis, which has a fairly rich history in statistics, sequential analysis, or change point analysis, to detect changes in brain activity without prior knowledge about the exact onset or duration. So our goal was to make population inferences on, you know, whether, when, and how long an fMRI time series deviates from a certain baseline level. And then at the end, we wanted to be able to characterize brain responses in terms of the relationship to some physiological changes that we had, say reported stress, increases in heart rate, or whatnot. So what we did is we have this three-stage approach to analyzing this type of problems. In the first stage, we use a technique which we call HUMA, which is hierarchical exponentially weighted moving averages. And so this is a paper we published in NeuroImage last year. And this is kind of a screening process to determine voxels with time course that deviate from a certain baseline level in the population. I'll talk about this in the next slide. For voxels that have this deviation from a baseline, we do a more stringent analysis of them, and we estimate voxel-specific distributions of onset times and durations from the fMRI response, so from this bold response. And then as a final step, we perform spatial clustering according to some onset and duration characteristics, and we're using currently a hidden Markov random field model to do that. So here's kind of a basic overview of the HUMA analysis. So we're assuming that there's kind of a two-state model. It's either active or it's inactive. And it starts out in this baseline active state. So you're chugging along here with no activation, and then suddenly, bang, you switch states because you got really nervous, or the drug started working, or whatnot, or you got really stressed. And so what our goal here is to determine, did this take place? When did it take place? And, you know, and how long did it take before we got back to the baseline level? So the way we determine whether or not this take place is using what's called the series of UMA statistics. So this is exponentially weighted moving average. We weight each. So here the time series is x of t. So we weight each time series, and we take into consideration its past. So, you know, different values of lambda will take, you know, different amounts of past into consideration. If lambda is equal to 1, it doesn't take the past into consideration. If lambda is close to 0, it really takes the past into consideration. So by varying this, you know, we can get kind of temporally smooth curve versions of this time course. We combine this into a group statistic, which we call the HUMA statistic, by weighing each of these HUMA statistics using the inverse of the variance. So there's a within and between subject variation that we take into consideration. And so because we take both these terms into consideration, this can be considered a, you know, a mixed effects analysis that we can use in population inference. And then basically we search across time for deviations from the baseline to see whether or not there's activation or not. And we perform significance testing using a Monte Carlo simulation. So here we show that this is significantly deviated from the baseline in this red state, and then here it's in the baseline. So this would be a voxel where we have deviations from the baseline level. So we basically do this. It's a pretty straightforward approach. We do this for each voxel in the brain, and if there is a significant Huma statistic, we take this voxel to the next level and we analyze the characteristics about the onset and duration of activation. So when estimating these change points, when we're changing from the different states, we assume that each subject's time series is a sequence of normally distributed observations that may at some unknown time, which we call tau I. So tau is the onset at time I, for subject I. They may at that time undergo a shift in mean. So they're chugging along at baseline, and then at tau I, bang, they go up to the next stage. And this may be followed by a return to baseline at tau I plus omega I, where omega I is also unknown. So omega I is the duration. So you go on at tau I, and then at tau I plus omega I, you go back down. Okay? So both tau I and omega I are in our model considered to be random variables drawn from some unknown population distribution, g of tau and g of omega. And at the end of the day, that's what we want to estimate. We want to know that. What is g of tau? What is g of omega? So basically, these distributions are estimated assuming no functional form and allowing for the possibility of no response. If it's a stress task, you might have these guys that don't get stressed, or these gals that don't get stressed, and you have to allow for that possibility. And so, but the assumption we make is that we assume that contiguous observations come from the same component, except that these two time points, tau I and tau I plus omega I, where you switch component. So basically what you're saying is, okay, you're chugging along in this inactive state, so you're, and then at tau I, bang, you move up to this state, and then you move back down. These tau I and omega I are draws from some population distribution of these onsets and durations. So what we want to estimate, we need to estimate the parameters associated with this distribution, that distribution, and also estimate these distributions associated with tau I and omega I. Okay? And here's how we do that, but we're short on time here because they're always slower than I think. We can set up a likelihood function and use the EM algorithm to calculate the maximum likelihood estimates of these two distributions, G of tau and G of omega. And then finally, what we can do is kind of an interesting thing, is that once we have this information, we can use these estimated distributions to calculate the probability of activation as a function of time. So once you know the probability of onset as a function of time, the probability of duration, you can actually calculate the probability of activation. So you can get kind of information about that as well, which is kind of neat. Here's a simulation here on some simulated data. So here you have some data that's chugging along a baseline state, and at some random time point it goes up to the next state, and after a random time it goes back down again. And using our method, we can estimate a distribution of onset and a distribution of width. And with this information and using this formula here, we can get this probability of activation as a function of time. And here you can see that, well, here there's no probability of activation. Here it starts going up. And this is this increase here. Then here everyone's active, so you get something close to 1, and then it goes back down again. Okay? As a final step, after we've done that, we're able to get characteristics about the onset and duration. We can calculate the expected onset, or the expected value of onset, or the expected value of duration, or even just use these distributions by themselves and cluster them according to both spatial and temporal characteristics. And we use a hidden Markov random field model to do this. Here the data y from each voxel is observed. That might be the expected onset or the expected duration or whatnot. But the cluster labels are unobserved. Where the Markov property here is that you assume that, conditional on your neighbors, it doesn't matter what far away people are doing. So that kind of is putting this spatial considerations into place. And then we use this iterated conditional modes algorithm by BSAG to approximate the maximum a posteriori estimate. There, that word comes back again. You'll hear again a lot of that to estimate the cluster membership. All right. So here's kind of an experimental an experiment where we applied this technique. And here we had 24 participants scanned in a 3-Tesla magnet. And the participants were informed that they were going to be given 2 minutes to prepare a 7-minute speech. and the topic which would be revealed to them during scanning. And after the scan, the speech would be delivered to a panel of expert judges. And I actually think they went in and they went on the internet and looked for the, you know, seven meanest professors they could find on the web, and they said that this is the judges, so it's just to scare them. And so this was kind of a stress-inducing task, and they wanted to see which people were stress-prone and which weren't. And so basically, they had a fixation time point, and then there's a speech instruction where they were told what the topic was. I think it was some hard-hitting topic. Was why you're a good friend. So you had 2 minutes to think of why you were a good friend to give the 7-minute speech to these mean judges. So during this time point, they were preparing their speech, thinking of why they were a good friend. They were also getting stressed out. Okay, and after 2 minutes, they came and said, well, you know what? You don't really need to hold this speech, so it's okay. And so then they got relieved, and then they had 2 minutes just sitting there relieved. Okay? These psychologists, I tell you. Stress and increased heart rate were reported throughout the entire preparation interval, and we kind of wanted to look at regions that were related to that. Here's the results of this human analysis, and so basically there's a bunch of regions here that show significant human activation. Most of it, here's the change point, and here's the activation duration. Most of it is taking place at around the time of the speech instruction, but here there's a region that's active after the speech. The relief, saying that you didn't have to give the speech. Most of it was transient, you know, basically just went on and off with short duration, but some of it was sustained throughout the speech preparation task. And here's a single slice that was of particular interest. And for this slice, you know, we looked at these 5 different regions, you know, which had spatially and temporally coherent behavior, and we calculated, you know, the distribution of the onset and duration, and used that to calculate the probability of activation across time. And this is kind of an interesting thing, because here we see, for the first region, which is the visual cortex, we see that it's blue here. That means that there's low probability of activation. And then suddenly, around where the visual cue is, it becomes very high probability of activation. And then that decreases directly. And so that corresponds to this, you know, this visual cue. We have 2 regions here, these superior temporal sulci, which also basically are transient, that they go on when the speech tap goes. They go on for a little longer, but not so much. This region here, the ventral stratum, here number 3, this is interesting because it has low probability of activation throughout, but then it has the highest probability of activation after the relief task. So that's a region that's been known to be associated with positive emotions. So that's presumably that they're really happy that they don't have to give this speech, and so that's becoming active there. And actually, the only region in the brain that has sustained activation throughout the whole task is this ventral medial PFC, and here's the human statistic corresponding to that. And you'll see that we did the same analysis for the heart rate. It kind of corresponds very closely to the heart rate, but a little bit lagged to the heart rate, but it's very close to that. And so we thought this was kind of cool, because this allows you to look at the fMRI time course in a different way than this. Now, usually you just get these statistical parametric maps, so you'll get a map of the brain, and then you'll get blobs of red and yellow telling you what the p-value is. But this, you know, we feel tells you a little bit more story. So, you know, you have these active regions, but it's also telling you, giving you temporal information about, well, how likely is it that this is active and not active throughout this time course? And in particular for studies of emotion and stress and whatnot, that could be very valuable information. So you know, I wanted to use this opportunity just to kind of present this. So the take-home points of my talk. Yeah.
A couple of questions.
Sure.
Can you just finish?
I have 2 more slides, so let me do it. Yeah, that's a good. Okay, so the take-home points here. So in many experiments, the exact form of the stimulus and HRF are not known a priori. And so the first part here is that, well, there exists a number of linear and nonlinear techniques for estimating the HRF, but not all of them are created equal. Some of them are much more, much better in terms of power, bias, and parameter confusability. And the second thing is that, well, you know what, if you have certain studies when you don't know the stimulus or you're not willing to make, you can use these change point methods to make inference about them. There's other things that you can do as well, but this is something that we've had some success with. And then finally, I want to thank all collaborators. The first part is joint work with Lauren Atlas, who's a PhD student in psychology at Columbia, Jiming Lo, who's a colleague of mine, and Tor Wager. And the second is joint work with Lucy Robinson, who's in the crowd, a PhD student in statistics, and again with Tor. And she did all of my simulations and coding, so I have to give her much of the credit for the later part there. And this MATLAB implementation of this human analysis is freely available on Tor's webpage as well. All right.
Okay, first question.
Yes. Yes, population effects, yeah.
So
restating the question. I'm assuming you mean these results, right?
Yeah.
And these results are over the population, yes, that's correct.
Second question. So the first part we have thought
yes.
about fitting the cases functions, I have a question about how would you find the activation maps or the voxels that are different from the top. Now, is it possible that your basis functions would fit to voxels that are not activating according to the task?
Well, yes. So this is a good question. He's talking about, well, when you're doing HRF estimation, can you do these statistical parametric maps as well? And this is what I was trying. I got a little rushed at this time point, but this is what I was trying to illustrate here: is by doing these times, by just estimating the time of the magnitude for each estimate, you can then do population inference on that, and this is what we basically did there. So yes, it is possible, and I think that it's often done. Within this GLM framework, but I don't think it's really often done in a good way, because if you have these basis functions, sometimes, like I was saying, that they only take the canonical HRF, even though they had temporal derivatives in the second level, and that always seemed very fishy to me. So I'd rather do something like this, because it seems like you're using all your information.
So I have a quick follow-up to that,
sure.
And that is, for the FIR, were you also just measuring the peak? I mean, because the FIR measures any shape, not just...
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah, we put some constraints on it that it had to be in a certain neighborhood and not at the end and things like that.
But is this actual intensity coming from an F-test for the FIR? Is it?
No. Here we just read off the amplitude.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a question way in the back.
Does the human model work if the baseline is in the middle or in the end?
How does it work? You mean the basis? The basis?
HEMA.
The HEMA.
That you always take the beginning as the baseline, right? What happens if the baseline is at the end or at the...
Well, that's possible as well. We usually use this baseline as a way of calibrating the system. So it doesn't really matter. We could use it for either.
Steve?
In your many modeling results here from the simulations, we can, I guess, that maybe the SFIR might be a good thing to use, but
yeah,
I
think
suppose
so.
We do going into real data, because we have no way of knowing that your simulation is going to match any particular.
Yeah, I mean that's the tricky part with any type of simulation. In your universe, it works quite well, but I think the purpose of this simulation was more that, well, in this universe, if you're just changing the amplitude, your model better just change. Your estimate should only change in the amplitude as well. And if it's not doing it in this nice universe, well, then what's it doing in the more complicated thing? So this is more just I see the simulation more as, well, you should be really careful in making what conclusions you should make, because if it's not working in this really neat system, then what can we really say about it in the wild? We have somebody back there.
So the change point analysis, how do you feel with the baseline trips?
Oh, that's a very good question. So in the human model, so the question was, when you have this change point, there's often these baseline drifts in fMRI data. We remove them using high pass filters and things like that. Because if you don't do that, that could presumably give you that. And if you don't remove it well enough, you could still get significant humor results. And that's why we only use it as kind of a first stage, because then if you do these, you know, even things like motion and things like that could give you significant humor results. But then when you look at it at a second stage, you can kind of clear that off. So we use the humor more as a screening process to get rid of, you know, the vast majority of voxels. And then because we're not certain whether there could be some other issues involved, we do the second and third stage analysis as well.
Does the fact that your second method assumes basically a one-to-one in timing between the changes in the ball signal and the baseline makes it non-applicable to short events, because there is going to be a
That's a good question, because if you have multiple trials and things like that, it's a little bit trickier. So we're working on some sort of extensions of that because of the fact. But right now it's best for the type of experiments that I was explaining. But that's a very valid point.
The same.
Okay.
And over here,
Sai.
Can you use different baselines for different baseline functions for different parts of the brain?
Different basis sets.
Baseline.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is in the human analysis. Okay, now I'm mixing up absolutely. Each voxel has its own baseline calibration. So yes, absolutely.
Is it possible to extend the humor to model like parametric variations in activity?
Yeah, that's another one of these things that we want to do, because, you know, there can be differences in these things. It might not only be a two-level model; it can be an eight-level model or something like that, because you might have stepping up. You know, so that's also another natural extension that we've been thinking about. Yeah, you guys are very good. I'll write them all down. The UMA. Without the H, that works on the first level, and so we have an inference methods for that as well. The HUMA is then the hierarchical version of that works on the population. So yes, it does. Yeah. There's no problem.
I had a question. So with the HUMA, you basically have to test every possible baseline, because you're testing it relative to baseline, but then you don't know where that baseline ends. So do you have to do every single possible?
Yeah, usually we fix that. You know, the more baseline you have, the more stable you're.
For that experiment.
For that one particular one, we don't. All these things were designed with actual experiments in mind, and then all these things, you know, the suggestions that you're coming with comes with extending it to other ones as well.
So one of the things, one of your results was probability of activation.
That's right. Yeah.
So you're Bayesian.
Well, you know, I'm not a snob. See, my philosophy is that, you know, I'll do anything to solve a problem, so, you know, I'll use anthropology if it's going to help me, but it hasn't so far, but I'll use Bayes if it's going to help me. I'm not a snob.
Well, I guess I would say probably a mixture model setup, you might say.
Yeah, it's a mixture model setup. And also the thing about, you know, you'll hear talk about frequentists and Bayesians, often that, you know, if you choose your Bayesian priors, they become equivalent to frequentists. You know, it's tomato, tomato. You know, let's all get along, right?
I'll take the final question if there are no others. You mentioned using the Calhoun's derivative boost, that's only for when you're doing a linear model. You don't do that. That doesn't get mixed up.
No. That's only Calhoun's derivative boost is only when you do the canonical HRF plus its derivatives, and so that was just basically because I've always gotten a little. I've always been very confounded by the fact that you fit these basis functions and then you only use one of them, and so I thought that was a reasonable way to get around.
Okay, let's thank Martin again.